You're listening to Deep Tech Unleashed, an NGP Capital podcast from the founders for the founders, the challenges and the moments of magic.
Welcome to Deep Tech Unleashed. I'm your host, Christian Noske, a partner here at NGP Capital. And if you're involved in running a deep tech startup, this podcast is for you. Each episode explores a different aspect of founder life and the challenges, opportunities and moments of magic each one brings. In our first episode, we began our journey with exploring enterprise sales with Peter Fankhauser, the CEO and co-founder of Anybotics. And I'm very much looking forward to continuing the journey with today's guest and another important topic that is on the minds of many deep tech founders, selling to governments and public institutions. It is a privilege to be joined for this discussion by Cyril Cabara, the founder and CEO of France-based Shark Robotics, a world-leading deep tech company with the most noble of goals, saving lives through technology. Shark Robotics combines hardware, software, and AI and resistant batteries to design and manufacture fire safety, security, nuclear, and space robots to get people out of harm's way. So, Cyril, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Christian. It's great to be here. Just to give a short intro for to listeners, I'm Cyril, 40 years old. I'm the CEO of Shark Robotics, a French company based in La Rochelle with a team of 75 people. And the mission of Shark Robotics is to save lives through technology. We design and manufacture robots for dangerous environments, including firefighting, mining, and law enforcement. And to date, we have delivered more than 300 robots in 16 different countries. And our current strategy is mainly focused on firefighting. And in this sector, actually, we hold a worldwide leadership position. And in addition, I'm also a husband and a father of two young kids, Leonor and Achille, who are respectively 5 and 4 years old.
Thank you, Cyril. And I'm sure this was a long journey to get you to this point today. Maybe you can talk a little bit about why you chose this, why not something else? How did it get started? Was it always like that? Or did you start with a totally different idea and ended up here where you're today?
Yeah, for sure. I have an atypical background, quite different from the traditional path of an entrepreneur who usually start in a business school. First, I spent 9 years in the army in a special unit focused on the human intelligence. We call that HUMINT. And to explain to listeners, this job is mainly gathering intel, so information, behind enemy lines. So you are part of a small team of 6 people deployed all over the world. And I made several missions in Africa, in Afghanistan, and in Middle East. And after 9 years of good and loyal service, I left the army to transfer my skills from the military intelligence to the business intelligence. So I go back to school. And I graduated with an MBA from the Economic Warfare School based in Paris, and which is specialized in competitive and business intelligence. And then I founded Shark Robotics at the end of 2016 in order to provide robotic safety solutions for men and women who are working in dangerous environments. And when I look back at the story of the company, we moved from being a project-based company, to a product-driven company. So initially, we were a startup designing and manufacturing customized robots for various sectors like nuclear, space. And in this case of a project, the process is completely different because you're selling the study, followed by the manufacturing, and then the qualification and testing phase. And after a few years, we decided to focus our strategy on becoming a product-driven company, especially focused on firefighting, demining, and law enforcement. This means reducing our sectors and reducing our robot portfolio to standardize our catalog robots. And the main goal, why this move? Because the main goal is to scale And when you speak about deep tech company, it's more easier for the manufacturing process and the process to produce. I mean, only few product and repeat it. It's easier for the quality, easier for the process. And I mean, at the end, it's easier to scale. So now we have delivered more than 300 robots in 16 different countries, mainly based in firefighting. And from the data, I mean, just to explain to listeners what is the main value, because from the data we gathered, the added value of the robotics in firefighting is not just about saving lives, is more about, let's take an example to make it more visual. One of the most common type of fire is a warehouse fire. So the issue with this kind of fire is that after just 15 minutes, temperature get become so high that the mechanical structure of the building can directly collapse. Okay. So when there is not robot on the scene, firefighters are not allowed to go inside the building. So instead, they place a fire truck around the building and they throw water and they spray for, hours during maybe sometimes days. And at the end, this can use millions of liters of water. When you think about the losses for the company, everything gets destroyed by the water, production facility, the stocks, the goods. So of course, insurance companies are also take a hit and there are a big environmental impact also, of course, because of the polluted water. So, it's very important. So mainly based on this fact, the KPI of the robots are, of course, saving lives because you protect them, enhancing the efficiency with the ability to operate indoor and detecting hotspots and make a surgical strike inside the building. And also you reduce the loss ratio for companies and insurance company. And you reduce, of course, the water consumption by 10 times.
Yeah, lots of stuff to unpack here. Maybe first on your background. In Europe, I only know a handful of founders that had a military background. And so maybe just a cultural organizational question to you. The army, and maybe that's a stereotype to those like me that haven't been in the army, but it's very structured hierarchy. You need to follow orders. And the startup on the other side is creativity, like being very quick, inventing things on the fly, not having always a plan and kind of planning on the go. There's a lot of maybe for most people, maybe opposite characteristics to that. I'm just curious how you as a CEO and founder now brought those totally two different, potentially totally different worlds together in your journey as an entrepreneur now.
It's a very good question because, you're right. When you see the army is very hierarchical, and the startup can be very chaotic. So it's right. But when you compare at the end, the army and a startup, the goals and mission are different. But at the end, there is a lot of things in common. For example, when you look at the process is the same because in the army, you have the vision, the strategy, and the execution. So for example, the vision is given by the politics. The strategy and the execution is made by military. But when you look at in the startup company, the same thing, because the vision is made, of course, by the board and the strategy and execution is made by the CEO and all the team. So, the main important thing to execute these missions is the management, because when you execute your plan during 5 or 10 years without any management, how you could do it? So it's very important to have something with a good management and not so chaotic, because you could do that when you just start with just 5 guys for everybody and like a young startup, everybody does everything with just do it mentality. But once the company grows to 50 people and more, that's not possible anymore. And second, this is the risk are very high both in the army and also in the startup. I mean, every decision counts and every recruitment is really important both projects for the army and all startup. As the founders, you take risk to disrupt the market and bring a new product to life. So it's the same process at the end. So you depend on the guys around you and you need to take care of them with a true and effective management. So that's why, the most common things when you need to You need to have leadership. And that's where the leadership comes in. It's a commitment to the men and women who believe in the project, if you are in the army or if you're in a startup.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And I have seen the discipline and hard work that comes from the army, from the training, working really, really well in startup world. So can only confirm that very good experiences on that. Maybe just double clicking on the use case and where you're used today and there. Before this recording here, we had a conversation and you raised the point that in Notre Dame fire a few years ago, you actually played a role. And so obviously most people know about this fire that unfortunately happened there. So just curious, besides a warehouse, which is obviously material and it can be rebuilt, but Notre Dame, it's a different animal altogether. So curious on your role there and how you helped.
Of course. And it's interesting because, the Colossus was our first project because at that time, it was the beginning of the startup. So we were just 8 people. And the main idea was to get firefighters and engineers together around the table to design the best robotic tool for them in a closed development loop. So we funded the project and the Paris Firefighting Brigade testing the robot before they decided to buy. And it was this robot, so the number one, who was used in the Notre Dame Cathedral fire at 900 degrees Celsius during 10 hours because the temperature was so high that the mechanical structure of Notre Dame was melting down. And so the general at this time decided to move out all the firefighters who were engaged in the operations and to send the robot over there to reduce the temperature, find the hotspot and make surgical strike. And it was a huge changement, in terms of application around the world when they deployed this robot over there, for sure.
Yeah. And Colos is the name of the first robot, just to clarify.
Yeah, Colossus is the name of the first robot. I mean, just to explain for listeners, is a very compact robot, like a Lego tools. So you have 10 modules. And every firefighter can change any module in 30 seconds with any tools. So you can, for example, extinct a fire, make a ISR, so intelligence surveillance reconnaissance missions. You can extract a wounded person. You can carry equipment. So it's very compact, 500 kilos, so very powerful. You can displace a car of more than 1 ton and with 12 hours of autonomy. And the idea is to be the perfect tools for firefighters. So with a minimum logistic footprint.
Yeah. No, thank you so much for all the background. Maybe switching gears a little bit and going into the challenges and opportunities specifically of selling to governments and public institutions who ultimately are your stakeholders. So there are certain skills that are a key to sale in any example, whether it's a big enterprise, a small enterprise. And so can you maybe talk a little bit about the clear differences in the skill needed to sell to government bodies and public bodies overall compared maybe that are totally different than in the free economy where that would not be as important or maybe only a small component to the overall sales process?
Yes, when you sell to public bodies, you are in processing B2Gov. We call that business to government. So you're most of the time, when you look at the sales, you most of the time on a long lead time process, sometimes 2 or 3 years. So you need to find and qualify good distributors around the world based on 3 main points. The network, so the ability to navigate government ministries and being well connected from your resellers around the world. His ability to market your product. And when I mention market, is not just show your product, but having the knowledge of the market. So if I'm selling a demining robot, you need to be in a defense. If I'm selling a firefighting robot, you need to be in a fire truck business. So because the DNA of the business will be completely different. And also is financial capacities, because since they will buy and resell your product, their financial stability is crucial, because in the industry, you will ask for an upfront payment usually. So you need to be very accurate and precise in following the deal. Because it's a long lead time compared to the private, and you have to be consistent in your actions. And again, Intelligence to know the market and competitors is very important. So that's the most key important things when you look at for the sales, for example.
You're doing this for a few years, and I'm sure everybody that either starts a business or just wants to learn more is curious if there are some maybe tips and tricks, best practices, whatever you want to call them. Like, don't do this, definitely do this. This helps. Like cutting a year off or even 6 months, of course, can be determining between life and death of a startup. Is there anything specific that you would think of? And then maybe also, you know, Peter Frankhauser in the last episode talked about finding your allies, finding your people that can be the ambassador of your product in the company that you want to sell to. Is this also something that helps you within that acceleration?
Definitely, because the DNA of the public sector is completely different from that one of the private sector. First, as founders, you need to go fast. And the concept of time is different. For a startup, you know, short-term timeline might be 1 month, while in the public sector, it's often 3 or 4 months. Second, usually B2Gov prefer CapEx offer over OpEx offer, since they have budget for acquisition that are more significant than operational budgets. Because, you know, they gather budget from public bodies like EU, region, departments. And the third, when you speak to a public sector as a startup company, usually and unfortunately, there is often a lack of knowledge about the challenge faced by SMEs. Because to be honest, they don't understand what it's like to struggle to pay salaries at the end of the month. So the main important difference is, of course, the selling process. Because, like I said, it's a long lead time, so you need to be very accurate. The payment terms also were quite difficult because as a startup company, when you deal with public bodies, you will be paid at the end of the mission with 45 or even sometimes 60 days. And of course, one important thing is the exposure to international events, because you're way more exposed to international events if you've been working on a deal for 2 or 3 years. So you need to you can afford to be overly concentrated on a certain region of the world. You need to be clearly exposed to diversify the risk, of course. That's this kind of example.
Yeah, and I mean, you said you're already in 16 regions, which I think for many startups is also not quite normal at this stage of the journey. But you said don't try to sell OPEX, sell CAPEX. This is, I guess, a trick. If you're trying to hit the wall there, you will not get anywhere. But on that specific question, just to double click on it, of course, startups and also investors like myself, we like to see recurring business. And we want to see AR. How do you manage those two aspects? And you raised a lot of capital, and we can talk about this a bit later, but how do you manage the VC expectation, your own expectations? Recurring has advantages, and then the government realities that you describe.
Again, for investors, that's why it could be frustrating when you go in a deep tech company as a SaaS, with a SaaS mindset, you know, because of course you focus on the annual recurring revenue, but when you look at in the B2Gov system, you don't have any time of this because it's a long lead time. And so that's why, for example, in Sharkwave, we will talk about that later. We try to diversify our offer to have something in private as a robotic as a service. But when you look at specifically in the public, in the B2Gov very specifically, selling to the public body is like a chess game, you know. You need to have a clearly map out, the decision makers to figure out who are your allies. And this is very long lead time. And as, you know, they gather budgets from the European Union and different, usually they have more acquisition budgets than operational budget. So that's why it's very critical to understanding the landscape and who hold the power, in the public bodies when you discuss with them.
Yeah, thank you for that. And The way you work with governments, the company, I can go on LinkedIn, right, and look who is the procurement person, who is the head of AI or whatever. That's not really possible in government. How do you even identify the right person? You said like identifying the person, identifying your allies. How do you do that when you're just getting started in that business?
I mean, it's very important to rely on the capacity of your network and your distributors to have the good intelligence process to clearly identify, I mean, who are your allies at the top level of the castle, and also who are the allies of the of your competitors. So usually you can go in different ways because you can have the support from your distributors, but you can also use, of course, lobbying capacity, of course, from public affairs, for example.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And from a team perspective, maybe also, obviously you can't do it all alone. Do you hire people from the government to do this better, or do you not really see any difference between the way you have to hire and a company like Anibotics or other robotic companies that are selling to classic enterprise customers?
Yeah, it's important. I mean, you need to have a bottom up. You need to have a bottom up approach, but also a top down. So that's why when you go, for example, in the firefighting sectors, if I take an example, you need to have guys who were on the operational fields in the firefighting to know the product and to have the return of experience. And because it's important to understand what is the real needs at the end. So this is very important. But also from our resellers, usually, yes. I mean, they have hire people in the government where they hire in order to open tender, open the budgets and discuss about what will be the next, needs in terms of acquisition in certain countries. So that's why you need to work closely with our distributors network, and you need to qualify for every country in the world. So, you know, based on the export phase, we are selling as B2B to B2Gov.
Yeah. No, and I think that's probably true for many industries. You need to have industry insight to be able to speak the same language. And that's what I'm hearing from you here as well. We looked a little bit at the past, but can you maybe talk a little bit about the future in terms of challenges that you are working on right now, that you're solving, whether that's related directly to selling to governments and how to unlock that complicated sale process, or just on the technology side? So very broad question, really.
I mean, we're working right now in developing a new fully autonomous robot specifically for firefighting, but in B2B environments, so for car parking and warehouse. And this will be deployed as robotic as a service. So the system will be integrated directly into the space, allowing the robots to detect threats, move autonomously to the fire and contain it for 40 minutes. And plus, the robot will have the capability to send data back to the firefighter, enhancing, their situational awareness. So it's like a bridge between the private sectors and the government, and the private and the public sectors, because firefighting play with our robots to extend fire, but the most critical part is in the 15 minutes at the beginning of the fire. That's why you need a robot directly in the warehouse or in the car parking in order to detect the early fire and to go to extend and contain the fire during these 15 minutes, because this is where this is most critical. And one data which is very important, that 80% of the company who faced a fire never came back. So that's very important as the protection of economic operators on the field, of course.
Yeah. I mean, we're always speaking about ROI and 80% of businesses essentially disappearing is quite a direct and very great proof point of a ROI having a robot of yours already in the factories or warehouses, wherever it might be. So one last question on the selling to government side. Is there any specific advice that you would give other deep tech founders that are either considering or starting a new company that we haven't talked about yet, that we say, if you would do it again, this advice you would have loved to hear of your younger self?
Yeah, of course. And it's funny because my best and my worst would be the same advice, because when it comes to sales, okay, on the public, you can't think like an engineer who believes he developed the best product. So no matter what, he's supposed to win, because at the end, it's not the best product that will win. It's the one that has prepared the battlefield. So if you notify, like we said, and get close to the right persons, you will secure and win the tender. But also, this is not so a good advice, because if you, could be a worse advice, because if you sell crap and don't make all the effort to improve the quality to sell at the best product, you will never get reorders. And to scale, you need first-time acquisition lead customer, but also you need reorders, otherwise you crash.
Yeah, so basically you have to be good in everything. great. Thank you for that. And just one question. It's not quite related to our main topic here of selling to governments, but it is an important question for any deep tech company. And you have robots, so I have to ask. In-house production versus outsourcing. This is always a kind of a hovering question over every hardware company, and there's normally a middle ground for most companies, or a starting point and then an end point. How is it for you? Are you producing completely in-house? Have you always been doing it this way? What will it look like in 2-3 years?
This is a huge question, because we could easily talk for an hour and more about this topic. It depends completely about the nature and the development of the company, because, for example, at the beginning of Shark, we relied heavily on in-house production, for example, for milling and turning, or the production of the robot. And when we were a project-based oriented, this allowed us to manufacture prototypes quickly with the R&D very close to the production unit, so giving us flexibility and agility. Okay. But today we focus our strategy on scaling firefighting products. So which means standardize and industrialize our robots. So we've keep the assembly in-house, but we've outsourcing milling and turning in order to have scalability. And this approach gives us the capacity to upgrade our production while reducing our capex. That's quite interesting. So it depends completely about the nature of your company and how you be focused.
Yeah, no, that makes completely sense. Maybe just totally 180 here on the topic, but want to just wrap the discussion on those challenges that you described here on a personal note. You know, your job is obviously one of the hardest you can imagine. There's not much more than building a company that is all time consuming and also weekends and hard with the family at the same time. As you said, you have a family. But can you maybe, and that could also be an advice, but primarily your own experience, what gives you energy or purpose at the end of the day? And the purpose, it's maybe easy with your job, it's saving lives, but what is really giving you this balance, this energy at the end of the day to continue doing it and continue running against the wall potentially and being not as fast as you always want?
I will provide an easy answer, but outside works, I mean, my family and my kids are what truly give me energy and purpose. Because, I mean, you need solid, HQ, we call that in the army, you know, when you quit the job and when you quit, you have the weapons, and this company is a real fight. But when I look at them, it's given me power. So also as a founder, the sport is important to me to help me to release the stress and being combative for business, to have a clear mind and, of course, the resilience in order to face the challenge.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for that honest answer. So as I said, let's move away from the challenges. Of course, it's great. This is all what we want to discuss here really in this show, how to overcome challenges and how to solve it and give advice to others so whole deep tech founders can hopefully benefit from knowledge. But we are also always asking here to pick those moments of magic from their career, or could also be from your founder experience right now, where those breakthrough moments happen, when this hard work paid off that you just described, and then those sacrifices of a founder and the whole team paid off, and you really overcame it. And we call this kind of deep tech moment of magic that is unleashed. And so there are, I'm sure, a lot of moments, but we ask you to pick three here. So if you can maybe start with your first moment of magic where this whole experience unfolded the way I just described.
Honestly, it's very tough to pick just one moment, because when I look back, I would say it's been a hell of a road. And the fight is not over yet. But because for me, the most important thing is to stay in the present and focus on the mission. And, you know, each day bring its own challenges and opportunities, and every decision counts. So, you know, there's a Buddhist sentence. It goes, you need to push forward without regretting decision about the past or being paralyzed by thinking too much about the future. And it's very important as an entrepreneur, because you need to be in the present. And so don't go too much in the past. Don't go too much about the anxiety of the future. And it's very hard sometimes. Okay, let's try. If I had to pick up a moment, I would definitely tell the fire of Notre Dame. You know, as I told you, it was kind of tragic and magic, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, our first unit was the one who was engaged in Notre Dame. And the funny thing is that in that case, I was at it was in April 1990, I was in the maternity with my wife, because she has she was having contractions. So suddenly we started getting bombarded with message and phone call from the TV station and journalists about how our robot was deployed in the fire in Notre Dame. And at the same time, it was, like I said, tragic about Notre Dame, but it was because a part of our culture was going down. But also, the moment was very impressive because it showcased to the rest of the world that robotics can be used in extremely harsh environments, I mean, more than 900 degrees Celsius, and it changed the mentality everywhere on the planet. So people began to see the potential of robotics in emergency situations, and not just as a concept, you know, but as a practical solution that can make a real difference. So actually, it created the market at this time. So it was a huge moment, definitely.
And later on, obviously, then you had the journalist calling, the world saw that this is actually possible. Did you have other moments of those kind of moments of magic, so big aha moments where people really saw the power of the technology when it does a trick? I mean, and you're also not just in fire, right? You're also in other industries. So I'm just wondering if you had similar moments in other industries.
I mean, it's the whole mission is important. So, of course, I can give you a lot of examples to have the smile of an operator, of a man, of a woman who are deployed in critical environment. And when you see, okay, you provide the robotic tools at the beginning, it makes them laugh. So, you know, at the beginning, we go crossing them, showing them the robots for demining for operators in firefighting. But they were laughing at us to say, okay, this robot will take our job. They were laughing at this. And at the end, it was very good to see that when they use it and they test it, I mean, they were feeling very close about the robotics. And that's the beauty of the thing. Because at the end, you really see the robotics as partners of the human. And that really means something for us. Because I mean, usually you see the robotics against the men in terms of works, in terms of environment, and it's a lot of sectors. But when you look at the end, I mean, if you look at the cooperation between a man and a machine, it's 80% more powerful and efficiency if you have a combination by them. So it's a multiple of experience like this who show me at the end that the willing between the man and the machine was good and was very, very efficient. And it was very funny about that.
And is there a different reaction from different security safety personnel? Like a firefighter is more skeptical and a police officer or whoever is other safety personnel is more open? Is there different type of reactions to your technology?
It depends completely about the maturity of the operators, because when you look at in different sectors, for example, if you look at the mining sectors, they were used to play with robots like this, the mining robots, since 10, 15 years. I mean, before, I mean, in Afghanistan in 2001, they already have robots over there. So they're already the more mature in terms of using what is the use case. But in 2017, when we came with the first robot, they were first scared because they say, okay, this robot will take my job at the end, yes or no? And the second thing is, okay, this robot will be not capable to follow us in harsh environments. So the main idea and the most important things was to put around the table engineers and firefighting and to say, no, it's not just a robot, it will be your robot. So you need to improve it in a closed development loop. That's why our first robot, when the firefighter tested the first robot, the technology readiness level was very low, just 7. And at the end, the maturity of the robot upgrade, thanks to firefighter and their return of experience, and we improve the machine. So now when you look at the Colossus, for example, we are the generation 2.5. So we made several closed loop development with them in terms of maturity, development of new modules. So it depends really about the market, and it's very important to understand that when you place a new product on the market, because if you don't put on the market prototype, the most threat is after 2-3 years of development, when you go on the market with a product you think is the best, there is no product market fit, because the guys say, okay, no, it's not this kind of issue that I want the robot fixed. So you need to go be ready, to deploy really, really fast on the market your product. This is the most important thing. Even if it's a prototype, you don't care, and even for deep tech companies.
And you're also in many different countries. Is that then different in different countries, different in Europe versus North America, how people react? Or is that pretty much the same for profession? Yeah.
It's a very good question, because depending on the region of the world, if you go, for example, to Southeast Asia, we work with Singapore firefighters, and they are way much used to robotics, AI, digitalization, about the C4I, so the intelligence, the map out all the firefighters on this scene. Okay, and when you go back in Europe, we start to evangelize in 2016. So now, You in Europe, you may have approximately 150, 200 robots deployed in Europe. But when you go, and it's funny in US, because usually they are on the top leading on term of innovation. But when you go on a firefighting, their use case is quite different in a firefighting, because they are more aggressive in term of use case. For example, traditions could be a barrier against the innovation, because when you go to present the firefighting robots, and we discuss right now with FDNY in New York, at the beginning they were okay, but a firefighter need to go in. It's very aggressive. Even you have risk. This is the mentality. You need to go fight. You need to go in the in the zone, in the dead zone. And so it takes time. But the good thing with the US is, this shift is made very hardly and very quickly compared to Europe, also East Asia. They go hard on it. So you need to convince, like we did, the Paris firefighter, which is an elite, a very important brigade. We did the same, and we will do the same with the FDNY, and then to shift the market very fast.
And does it help you then to be a French, a European company to come to the US? Because sometimes there's this, okay, technology should come from the US for US and for, in France, from a French company, Germany, German company, and so on. Is there any advantage or disadvantage for you there right now, where you come from, where you're building the robots?
I mean, it could be an advantage if you see, for example, they are very pragmatic, okay, to answer this question, because if you say, okay, I have a technological advance and they are, operational who are deployed on the field. So if you say, okay, your work will be enhancing by this kind of added value, thanks to my robots, they will take it. When you go to tenders, of course, and legal guidelines in terms of public, selling to public, yes, you need to have a reseller in US who will have, the number of vets or veterans from the army, who will have all the certification, the qualification to sell to the publics. But for the firefighters, directly to the army, it's a very fragmented market. So you need to convince the firefighter from the town, and the budget will come from the town and the states. So it's not directly the MOD who you will talk with, and you need some time. It could be very long because you need to convince them. Then your production will be in US. Then you will have some time of offset, etc. So depending for European company, it could be long. But if you have both a top down and a bottom up approach, you could go fast. Yeah, can go fast.
Okay. Oh, thank you for that insight. Finish our conversation, always asked about the future in the end. You are a deep tech founder, you're working on robots. That's already something most people only dream of. So you have a unique view on what's next. And so if you think about what technology in 10 years in the future you're most excited about, and of course, as every founder, you might say your own, but please try to use something that's not your own. In 10 years, what are you most excited about that we don't see here today yet?
I mean, if you take just one newspaper or something, you watch TV, the thing is, the most exciting thing is the AI, because while, some people see AI as a threat, I think we should view it as the chance to make our lives and our work better. Definitely can help us to work more efficiently, automating low-value tasks, and allow us to focus more time on creative and important work. So we face really two points of view between the threat, the power of the AI, and in every type of works, every type of environment. So not just robotics, when we mention AI, it could be design, art, robotics, automotive. So we see, in the next few years, we will have an important responsibility. Together, we need to push for the rules that ensure AI is used for good, because the next decade could bring a lot of wave of innovations that truly helps people. But if we don't put and manage this kind of guidelines, we face the risk to have some threats with the AI. And I come from the army. I know what I'm talking about when you mention AI and army, and not just about mapping a battlefield or something like that. You can weaponize it, and we need to take care about that, clearly.
Well, thank you so much, Cyril. Thank you for being with us today and sharing your experience with the listeners here. I can't wait to see what's next for Shark Robotics. I'm sure we will talk again. Thank you for being here.
You've been listening to Deep Tech Unleashed, an NGP Capital podcast. To find out more about our work helping deep tech founders turn big ideas into companies that shape a better future, visit our website at ngpcap.com or follow us on LinkedIn.